Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of The Vinyl Guide, especially you first-timers to the show. Here on The Vinyl Guide, we talk records, collecting, rare pressings, amazing finds, and more. And here on the show today, guess what? You are in for all of those. We are welcoming Andrew Milton of Parlagram Auctions to the show. Now, Andrew is quite the knowledge base on Beatles vinyl pressings. He puts a ton of info on Beatles vinyl through his great YouTube series on rare Beatles records. He even sells them through his service at parlagramauctions.com. And wow, he's had some rarities come through his hands, including White Album number 0005, a one-off acetate of What Goes On, and many more. Andrew even has a knack for finding old store stock from the 1960s, as well as amazing Beatles pressings, which he will discuss today. By the way, this is only part of the conversation. There's another 30 minutes or so available only to our Patreon community at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head over there now, join our community. It's a few bucks a month, but it helps keep this show going, and we thank you by making available extended interviews, early episode access, secret Vinyl Guide episodes, and more. So head over to patreon.com/vinylguide and hear the rest of the show. By the way, if you love the Beatles, we have a heap of other episodes available in our back catalog of The Vinyl Guide, including episode 222, the story of the Beatles butcher cover with Beatles historian Bruce Spizer. That's episode 222 of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 146, the Beatles White Album and the launch of Apple Records. Episode 146 of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 141 with Beatles collaborator Klaus Voormann. He joined us. Episode 141 of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 063, the Beatles history with VJ Records. Episode 57, the story of John Lennon's personal copy of the butcher cover, and heaps more. Subscribe and follow the Vinyl Guide podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you use, and dig for those episodes. And this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide is brought to you in part by AudiophileUSA.com. If you enjoy vinyl records and prefer them in beautiful shape, then AudiophileUSA.com is for you. They only sell excellent and near-mint used vinyl. Much of it is ex-store stock that has somehow sat in boxes and storage for decades, and they have a heap of titles, over 42,000 titles in stock in miraculous shape, which you could dig through at AudiophileUSA.com. Head over there now. Don't just stay on the homepage, but search for the artists, dig through the genres, search by the labels, go deep, and you'll find some amazing deals. That's AudiophileUSA.com. Go there now and find your holy grail. And we are also brought to you today by the Groove Washer, the best record, the best record cleaner in God's green earth. I use the Groove Washer daily. They have packages for any level of vinyl enthusiast, starter kits for vinyl hobbyists, and big jugs of Groove Washer G2 fluid just for record shops and ultra record nerds. You can't go wrong with the Groove Washer. Ask for it by name at your local record shop or go to groovewasher.com. and enter promo code VINYLGUIDE10 at checkout for an extra discount. You can't go wrong with the Groove Washer. That's groovewasher.com. Discount code VINYLGUIDE10. All right, let's start the interview. Remember, there's another 30 minutes or so available at patreon.com/vinylguide. Join us there, help support the show, and enjoy this extended interview and more. Now, let's catch up with Andrew Milton, working hard on all those Beatles vinyl collectibles at parlagramauctions.com. Andrew.
Hi, Nate. Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly.
Brilliant. I can hear you too.
Of course, that would be your Zoom image, all those Parlophone labels. How do you make time to do this? How many hours a day do you listen to the Beatles?
A lot. I don't like to think about it too much, but I pretty much do it every day. I mean, I don't really do anything else these days. And of course, if I'm selling records, I have to listen to it. You know, when you sell a record, people expect it to sound you know, as good as you say, and you have to listen to it. And I listen to an albums every day. You know, it's good. It's great.
I think it would be good for a while, but after the 500th time of listening to the Piggies song, I mean, at some point you got to draw the line. It becomes actual work.
Well, there are certain things you get to where you go, oh, not again. If I have to listen to another Mono White album, it's like, oh, it's like an hour and 45 minutes and I've got to sit down and I've got to listen to it. And sometimes when you're grading things for sale, you stop listening to the music. You start listening for what's wrong with the record. You know, you start listening for crackles, you start listening for ticks, you start listening for groove wear, and sometimes you sort of forget the music. So I'm sort of happy I've moved into sort of, when I'm doing the YouTube videos, I'm listening to different things now. I've just finished a video on German albums, which I haven't really listened to before. And I can hear they're different masterings, they're different pressings, and you different little alternate versions, and you can hear different things. And so that sort of thing keeps me interested, if you like.
You must have incredible ears to be able to tell the differences between the... I mean, look, if I were to play a particular cut, like a dash one and then a dash three master of the same LP, could you tell the difference?
I think so, yeah. I think I'd have to admit to be able to tell the difference between those things, yeah. But it's just something you get used to, and you listen to them every day. And I primarily focus on UK records. So, you know, I've listened to these albums hundreds of times, and I know every little in and out of everything, when the next pop's coming up, when the next edit's coming up, you know. So it's just something you get used to. But I never get tired of listening to the Beatles. So, you know, whatever mood I'm in, I put an album on and it'll cheer me up. And it's just a joy. You know, what better thing could there be, really?
Well, look, that's true. Look, and it sounds like you were absolutely built for this job. Andrew, I know we cracked right into it. I got to say, I absolutely love your YouTube channel.
Thanks.
I learned so much from it. It's like some of my friends and I, you're like our Tarantino. Right? Have you seen the new video? Have you seen what he's talking about now? And it is so so well put together, so entertaining. It's just, you know, and I would encourage anyone who's a fan of collecting and records and of course the Beatles to look up Parlogram Auctions on YouTube and make sure you have an afternoon ahead of you, because you just go from video to video to video. Some of the things that you brought to light that I didn't realize, for example, when the Beatles were signed to Parlophone, it seems like Parlophone was a bit of a dumping ground for EMI. That's where they put the artists that they didn't have a lot of, I'll call it, faith in. Maybe they didn't know what to do with, but it wasn't by any means some sort of premium brand for EMI. Is that right?
Yeah, they were very much the poor relation of the EMI family. I mean, you had HMV and Columbia. And they had Cliff Richard and Norrie Paramore, who was their big house producer. And he got like first choice of all the things that were coming along. Yeah, Parlophone was very much a space for things which came in on license from America sometimes, and all the comedy records, all the very light, easy listening records that were popular in the late 50s, the traveling records, you know, sort of music from Arabia and a Holiday in Beirut and all these sort of things, you know, they would get dumped on Parlophone because basically I don't think anybody else wanted them. And, you know, they had the moments with singers like Matt Monroe and whatever. But up until the Beatles hit in 63, I mean, when I went through the album catalog, it was very much an adult orientated label. You know, it wasn't pop. There was some pop. Adam Faith was a big pop star and things, but it was very lightweight. You know, it wasn't Cliff Richard. Adam Faith was pretty lightweight. So yeah, they were very much the poor relation of the EMI family.
And to me, that would indicate that EMI, I mean, now we know the Beatles as, you know, practical gods, but back then EMI, it was just a gamble for them and they weren't expecting a lot, it seems.
No, I think they sort of, you know, threw a lot of stuff at the wall and saw what stick, you know, something should stick. But they had the equipment, they had the facilities to sort of try things out, you know, and if they didn't work, then fair enough, they'd go away. But, you know, they had the assets to do that, which a lot of other record companies didn't. So that was obviously the way the Beatles stuck to the wall, if you like.
But at the same time, if they had this catalog of artists that were perhaps classical music, as you said, world music, the sounds of Beirut and things like that, the equipment that they had and the facilities for mastering and producing these records was actually made with perhaps a lean towards an audiophile's ear. Would that be fair?
Yeah, well, the recordings they made, as I said, from the especially from the Parlophone label with the Matt Monroe and whatever, they were aimed at an adult audience, you know, who had the good equipment. They weren't aimed at sort of mostly at your teenagers. You had the pop records, the pop singles like the Adam Faith, but most of their output was sort of grown up stuff, if you like. So, you know, they would have the better equipment than the teenagers would have.
I think on one of your videos, you were talking about Please Please Me, the gold label out of England, the very first run, that you could hear the tape splice in the cuts between the tracks.
That's true. Once a track ends, you can hear a slight hum or something, which is the reel, the leader tape between the tracks run through. That's just the you know, how pure the sound was coming from the tape to the mixer or whatever. That's how it was. But that's the only album you can do that on, actually. But it's remarkable how clean the first pressing of that will sound.
When you're listening to records and you're kind of getting in your mind like what the grade is and what the worth may be, are you able to discern between a record that was perhaps one of the first off the stamper and one of the last?
I'm not, actually. As I said, with EMI, their pressing quality was very consistent. There are people who will swear that, you know, the 1G sounds much better than the 7RMC or whatever. But really, I can't hear it. I can hear differences between, matrices numbers, recuts, you know, dash 1, dash 2, dash 3. But differences between stamper numbers, I can't do it. I've listened to a lot and I really can't hear it. There are some people who, this is a hot stamper, this is the, you know, that sort of thing, and they charge a lot of money for it. I won't say this sounds better than this one.
Right.
It's something I can't hear. I can hear a difference between a first pressing Rubber Soul and a second pressing Rubber Soul, but I can't hear a difference between 1G and 2F or whatever.
Okay. You started putting together your collection very early, and sounds like you were in a very advantageous situation where you could pick up a lot of these records quite cheaply in the 80s. What encouraged you to build your collection at a time when, I mean, let's face it, vinyl was pretty much out of fashion at that time?
Well, in the early 80s, I mean, I think vinyl was pretty healthy at the time. I bought a magazine called Record Collector back in the early 70s because it came originally wrapped around a reissue of the Beatles book, the Beatles monthly books, which were being reissued at the time. So I bought it for that and started reading around the outside of that magazine, which was Record Collector magazine. They had a list in the back of the top 100 rare records and sort of, course, I'm going to my record collection to see if I've got any. Of course, I didn't. But then that sort of got me thinking, you know, well, maybe I can find some, you know. And as I said, it was very easy those days to find 60s records lying around all over the place. I started advertising in the back of those magazines, and I put a wanted ad in once, I think in about 1981, and I used to get letters and things, used to send letters saying, I've got this, I've got Revolver for £5. Okay, so I'll have that. So you'd send a check off, write a letter back, and then post it. And then a week or so later, you get a record in the post. And it was like £5 each. And I remember this was the first pressing of Revolver with a dash one matrix. And it was just, this is so easy, you know, and they were such in great condition. So those were golden days of record collecting. But then in the 90s, I sort of dropped out a bit. I did other stuff and came back into it when I moved to Austria and when eBay started. And that sort of started the ball rolling with the collecting again. So I haven't sort of been solidly in it for the past 40 years. I've had some time out, and I think you need that. And just to start again. And a lot of collectors do, you know, people sometimes will sell their collections with me just because they want to start again, or they have you know, a divorce or something, or something where they need to get rid of their collection, and they start again. And the thrill is in the chase a lot of the time. So, you know, everyone's happy.
Mm-hmm. So at any given time, the phone can ring and someone's going to say, hey, Andrew, I've got this collection that I've had throughout my entire life. I'm looking to liquidate. I'm getting on in years. Will you sell it for me? Is that pretty much how it works?
Yeah, that happens. Yeah, I mean, it's happening more now, because of the pandemic, and people are sort of reassessing their lives and thinking, well, is that really worth keeping? I want to have some money to do something else. And of course, the first generation fans who started collecting back in the 60s and whatever, sadly passing away, and their collections are coming out from their families or something. So they're coming onto the market now. The cycle is moving round, if you like. You know, and sometimes I get them, sometimes they go in the bin, you know, sometimes they go to local auctions and things. But that's the challenge at the moment. You know, if you're faced with someone in your family has a huge record collection, has been collecting all their life, they pass away and the family is left with them. Sometimes the family don't want to deal with it. They just, you know, call the local dealer or take it to the local furniture sale, take it, get the house clearance people around, or throw it in the bin. You know, it's a small percentage of people will say, hey, we could do something with this. Let's put it on eBay. Let's call me or something. You know, so there's a danger at the moment. A lot of good stuff is going to slip away and sort of just disappear. So that's something which is coming round, especially in the next 3 or 4 years. You know?
Well, are you seeing the prices rise, the demand grow, or is it stagnating or declining?
Some things, prices are rising. The best stuff will always be worth money. The rarest things, your butcher covers, your low numbered white albums, your mint condition things, those prices are very strong and are going up. It's the rest of the things which are going down. Your average condition copies of normal albums. After 20 years of eBay, everybody's got everything. You know, all the Beatles collectors have everything they want. They've got a full set of mono. They've got a full set of stereo. What do they need? They need upgrades for their collection, or they need that something special to show off or to have in their collection. So a lot of the stuff that was worth fetching big money 10 years ago is now sort of junk status, if you like.
And is that impacted by recent reissues? Well, they're not so recent anymore. I know the 2014 mono box and the stereo reissues on vinyl. I mean, do they essentially influence a lot of the would-be collectors to dump the old ones and just stick with a new box?
Yeah, I think the 2014 mono box did have quite a profound effect on sales of collectible Beatles records, because it was so good. People didn't have to go chasing after mint copies of the originals. Now they had a set of records which sounded as good as the first pressings. So they didn't sell their first pressings or whatever, but it stopped them looking for them. You know, so if you had a 2014 mono box, you didn't need anything else. Thankfully, though, they were pretty limited, and not everybody got hold of one. And you can't get hold of one for under £1,000 these days. So you know, there's still a lot of people who want the decent sounding, the mint first pressings.
Do you think that they will reissue that box at any point?
No, I don't think so. Why should they? I mean, I don't see why they should, really. No, I don't think they will. They might do a stereo one, but I doubt it. It's difficult to second guess Apple with their stuff. You know, they're so odd in the way they think. They don't think like collectors. I don't know. I think they hear what's going on, but you know, they have to look at it from a business point of view, and it's very difficult to second guess them. But there's so much other stuff to do. You know, I don't think they will.
Okay, because I thought, all right, they've reissued all the Beatles stuff. They've made this great box set, which I missed out on, by the way. And then, you know, but that's getting close to 10 years ago now. What else do they have up their sleeve? Where else can they go with this Beatles catalog?
I think they're just going to remaster the rest of it now. They've got, I mean, everybody's waiting. They've done okay with the remasters of White Album and remasters of Abbey Road. They'll do Revolver. They'll do the other stuff as well. They've got, and that will take us through the next few years at least. So I think that's their next project. Box set wise, I'm sure they've got something up their sleeves. The singles they've done, maybe the EPs, maybe they'll do that. But yeah, I think the remixing and the remastering has been the thing which has worked for them over the past few years. So I think they'll continue on that vein.
Okay. But if more people want those box sets, why wouldn't they press up more?
Well, how is their market? Who is their market now? Is their market the first generation collectors? Is there enough younger people coming through to buy these sort of things? A lot of people are box set weary. You know, I nearly didn't buy the 2014 mono box because I don't usually buy a mono box. You think, oh, it's a box set, not another box set. Nah. So I think people are really bored of that, and they're expensive. And who is their market? You know, it's very difficult to do that. Are there enough young people coming through to buy collectible records, which is more of my concern? Mm-hmm. You know, how many, are there more people coming to buy first pressings of Please Please Me? I mean, I don't know. When the first generation collectors go, are there enough people coming through to continue that market going? Or is it just going to shrink and shrink and shrink till the only thing that people want are the top condition things, the rarest things that end up in the auction houses?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it seems to really be bifurcating, you know, the top end stuff pulls away and remains that blue chip record, that thing that you can hold up to your friends and brag about, and then everything else.
Exactly. Yeah, I think a lot of people who have big collections at the moment, you know, are sitting on it waiting for the right time to sell. I think they're going to be, if they do come to sell it now, they're going to be disappointed because there's going to be some things which will sell really well, mm-hmm. but they're going to be left with a lot of stuff which is not in fashion anymore. May have been 10, 20 years ago, but some things people don't want anymore, you know, and it's some things are pretty hard sell these days, you know.
So do you think we're in the middle of the Beatles bubble bursting?
I think it's bursting to a certain extent. The marketplace is changing. I think the peak was 2005, 2006, and then the financial thing came in that affected it a little bit. But since then, it's steadily matured, if you like. You know, as I said, the top stuff has gone up, and the rest of the stuff has gone down. You know, mm-hmm. So that's what we're dealing with at the moment. So that's why I'm sort of expanding my net, if you like, and going over to sort of discovering some different things which you know I hadn't covered before, because I'd stuck to the UK stuff and now I'm doing the German things, and mm-hmm. just trying to say to people, it's not just that, you know, don't just collect that. Why not have a listen to some German stuff, have a listen to some other things, you know? It's just finding different ways to listen to the Beatles, you know, and that's the thing, you mm-hmm. know, find something else you haven't heard before and something else to enjoy, a different mix, a different sound. It can really sort of open your ears to a different experience. And that's what I think a lot of Beatles people want. They know the music. They just want a different experience, you know, and to introduce that to other people, whether it's on cassettes or reel to reel or whatever, is something which I'm interested in doing at the moment.
So let's talk about some of the things that have come through PolyGram auctions, because it's some really incredible finds. First off, I think you had a very, very low number white album. Was it eight?
What? It was five, actually. It was number five.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, that came from, I was selling that on behalf of a collector, and who he had picked it up some years previously, and it was number five. And I think it was in, it was about 2015. And it was at the time, I think, the lowest one to come onto the market, and created quite a bit of a stir. And I think it reached 20,000 pounds or something. It was quite a lot of money then. I think it'd be worth a lot more now. But that was a nice find.
Now 0005, I mean, do you know where it came from, what the lineage was? I mean, it must have been the Beatles got the first four, I assume. Who was number five?
Yeah, that was the big thing. I didn't really know. The guy who was selling it to me, or who was consigning it to me, didn't really have a story. And that was the disappointing thing, because everyone was asked, where did it come from? Where did it come from? So you ended up saying to people, you know, the usual story of the Beatles getting the first four and whatever. So I don't know. I've seen a picture of number three, and number three I've seen. And of course, Ringo's number one. But, you know, I was listening to your episode with Bruce Spicer last night about the White Album that you did a while ago. And he explained all the things about the numbers and stuff. I'm looking for, I've got a lot of White Album sleeves, but I've never found a consecutive number one. I'd like to have, like, 45624, 45625, or something like that would be interesting. I never found a consecutive one. And a pretty number, you know, one with all the same digits or something, or 8484, something like that. Something that looks good. But, you know, I have an interesting, I was listening to this, your program with Bruce Spicer about the White Album. And I have an interesting story about this Peter Sellers tape from the White Album,
please,
which you were talking about. Because he was saying he didn't know where it came from. Well, it actually came from me. So I'll tell you that story. I was working for Phillips Auctioneers, a London auction house in the 80s, and as a rock and pop memorabilia specialist when I was very young. This was in 1988. And I remember one day, well, people would just walk in, you know, to the counter and say, I've got this, I've got this. Can you put it in an auction for me? Strange people used to wander in. Anyway, one afternoon, this chap wanders in and says, I've got this tape, you know, this reel-to-reel tape that I'd like to put in one of your auctions. I went, okay, what's on it? And he said, oh, it's the Beatles singing something. It was left to me by my father. And I was like, okay, all right. So I'll put it in. Started writing his details out. And he was Michael Sellers, Peter Sellers' son, who was left nothing by his father. He was left £800 by Peter Sellers when he died. He had a very difficult relationship with his father, and he was left £800 and this tape. And I thought, oh, Michael, I imagined he had like a treasure trove of things at home. I said, have you got anything else, you know, at home? He said, no, I've got nothing, just this tape. Okay, so he put it in the auction, and I took it home. I remember taking it home and putting it on my reel-to-reel and playing it and taping it on my cassette, which isn't the source of the bootleg, by the way.
Right.
It wasn't the source of the bootleg. I just recorded it onto a cassette, catalogued it, and put it into the auction. It came in its own box, and Ringo's handwriting was on the box. He'd written on the box the track listing and a little note and something. And it went into the auction, and it made £3,500, which was a lot of money back then. I mean, inflation adjusted, that's about £11,000 today, $15,000 or something. So it cost someone a lot of money back then. So Michael Sellers got he got actually more money from that tape than Peter Sellers left him in his will. And he died on the same day as his father. He died on the same day as Peter Sellers, but 2 years younger, from a heart attack. So it's such a tragic life, but it's just such an interesting story around this tape. And when I heard the tape had come out as a bootleg or whatever, and I was like, okay, I know where that came from.
Yeah.
So that was the story about that. But so I just wanted
to. Wow. You seem to have access to a lot of really interesting stock. For example, there's videos of you getting old store stock, Beatles records that are only now being unboxed. They've laid dormant somewhere for 50 something years. Mm-hmm. How do you find that sort of stuff? How does it come to you?
Just spend a lot of time looking at stuff, you know, spending a lot of time searching, and, you know, you put your feelers out, and people come to you, and you phone up friends and collectors. Those Magical Mystery Tour EPs actually came from Sweden. As a chap got them from a shop which closed down in the 70s. And I think he got 7 or 8 boxes of these that he had sort of liquidated himself over the years. And much to his regret, as he told me, he threw the boxes away. Once he'd sold the records, he just threw the factory boxes away. And this is the last one that he had, actually. So I thought, well, it's not every day you see that sort of thing. Sometimes you get American boxes full of Apple singles and things. I've seen things like that, but EMI factory singles from the 60s never turn up. So I had to have that.
And you sell them as one big box. You don't part them out and sell the box separately. You got to buy all or nothing.
Well, that was the big debate at the time. I put the, because I know someone else on another collector had bought a set a few years ago and sold them out on eBay, separated them. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the other boxes. And that was the big debate at the time. And I put in the video sort of, should I keep them together or should I sell them? And somebody was like, put them in a museum, keep them together. They're history. And the other people were like, spread the love, you know, sort of send them out and make 25 collectors happy. And rather than just somebody who has lots of money can enjoy them, you know, that sort of thing. So I've actually sold a few, so I'm not keeping them together. I think it's
you still have the box somewhere.
I still have the box. I still have the box. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the rarest thing, to be honest. The box with the label on it is the rarest thing. So, you know, it's Magical Mystery Tour. And I've made some people very happy and they have some things in their collection. And, you know, I have to sort of turn over my business too. So, you know, it's, mm-hmm. that's the way it is. You know, that's the thing about working in auction houses and doing the things that I do. You can own these things for a short time and then they pass on to somebody else. So I don't like to keep things for a long time. You know, I enjoy them and then I pass them on and get something else.
Right. Catch and release.
Exactly. I haven't got the money to sort of hold on to everything that I've had. You know, I would love to hold on to White Album number 5 or something and whatever, but you can't do it. So
what's the gem of your collection? What's the thing that you're like, I'm never getting rid of this?
Well, to be honest, I don't have a huge collection of Beatles things. You know, I have a collection of first pressings and I have the mono box. So those things I think are the most important. The sort of things, the big things I've had, I've sold. I sold like the What Goes On acetate that I had a while ago. But I have a recording of it. I can listen to it. And the physical things is not really a big thing. The music's the important thing. So they're worth a lot more to other people. And it just, if I sell something, it means I can buy something else, you know, and have something else. And so keep it rolling around. So, you know, I'm not one of these people to have a big collection in a big room and I sit around and look at it. It comes through me, you know, so it's refreshing all the time. You know, I've still got the basic things, the music, the original stuff is there and that's good. But the rest of it just sort of flows over the top and in and out. That's the way I like it.
Have you ever met a Beatle or at least become aware that one is aware of you?
No, I've never met one. No, I remember I did when I was working in the auction house, we sold a big collection of Buddy Holly stuff from a collector in America. It was everything from his driving license to his stage suit and stuff. And I sort of got an inkling that Paul McCartney was wanting to come and look at it because obviously he owns the publishing and is a big Buddy Holly fan. But no, they haven't really got that close. You know, the lawyers used to call up sometimes, but you know, that's about as close as it got. You would sometimes get an acetate or something or a promotional film and you'd put it in and then the letter from Apple's lawyers would come and say, what is this and where do you get that from? And we want to see it and take it out of the sale and burn it or whatever, you know. So, but no, the lawyers are as close as I've got to that, I'm afraid.
Okay. What is the most precious Beatles artifact you've held in your hands?
Ooh, that's a good one. I've had lots of letters and sort of personal things throughout the years. You know, John Lennon's glasses, some of their suits, and all these sort of things that passed through the auction house back in the 80s when this was all sort of new and this was a big deal. Everyone's become a bit sort of desensitized to it now, but back then it was headline news. You know, it was like in all the newspapers if you were selling John Lennon's glasses and stuff. Record wise it would be the White Album number 5 and the What Goes On acetate, but apart from that it would be lots of little bits, you know, like autograph stuff and things. But I've had them all at some point, so it's difficult to pick one particular thing out. You know, I could reel off a list, but yeah.
Now let's talk about that What Goes On acetate, because that was a little bit of detective work on your part that really kind of brought it to light. Is that right?
Yeah, it was originally offered in a memorabilia sale in London, and it was listed. It came originally from George Harrison's family. Who, not his immediate family, but some relatives who were selling off some of his things, a leather jacket, I think, some boots and a couple of other things. And this was in a lot with a copy of My Bonnie, and that was it. And it was catalogued as a acetate or lacquer disc, as I'm told you're supposed to say, of What Goes On. And it was catalogued as it wasn't really catalogued very well, actually, which is what drew me towards it. Was it an outtake or a recording of the Rubber Soul track, or was it the 1963 demo they'd recorded, you know, before they came up with From Me to You? Mm-hmm. So I emailed them and said, well, what is it? And they said, oh, it's just acoustic guitar and a bit of piano. and which didn't really tell me very much, but it told me that it was probably the early demo.
It was different than it was. Okay, did you know the existence of an early demo?
Yeah, I'd read about it because they had prepared it for recording in one of the early sessions before From Me to You, because that was going to be the next single. So I thought, well, this has got to be the early one. So I bid on it and I got it. And yeah, it did turn out to be that, just a guitar and piano demo of John and Paul sitting somewhere doing What Goes On with the original lyrics that John Lennon had written back in the 1950s. It's a lot of people's least favorite song anyway, in its as it came out on Rubber Soul. The version which was on the acetate was had different lyrics, but it was still pretty teenage stuff. It wasn't very good. So I can see why they left it. But yeah, it was a great find, and it'd never been released, it'd never been bootlegged, it had been written about a little bit. So that was a really exciting find, and I had it for a while. I enjoyed it, and now it resides in a collector's collection.
Has the audio from that acetate been made available in any way?
No, I don't believe so. Not from me, anyway. Sure. No, it hasn't. There was a talk at the time of like, well, you could release it, you know, because of the 50-year rule or something, you know, the copyright, you could put it out. But I wasn't going down that route at all, you know, with the mm-hmm. lawyers would get involved and all that sort of stuff. And it would have been a major hassle. But you could see it coming out on one of these sort of limited edition picture discs you see for in the record shops. But no, I wasn't going to do that. And I played it to a few people, and now it's gone, and I can't share it. I did actually put, I think, a 30-second clip on YouTube when I had it, just for those purposes. But it might be the subject of a video, a future proper video, because I still have the audio, but I don't think I'll be able to play all of it.
Yeah, you better be careful, though.
Well, yeah, people who buy
that's
these
not the attention you want to get.
Well, yeah, people who buy these things expect you not to sort of play it after they buy it, because obviously mm-hmm. it becomes public domain and the value of their copy goes through the floor. So it's a sort of unwritten rule that you mustn't do that, you know, and I don't think I will. It's mm-hmm. not.
What items are there out there, like a collection, you know, at some point it's going to see the light of day, something that you know is there, but you haven't gotten yet?
I have a collector friend in France who has a massive collection. His whole, the bottom floor of his house is a museum of Beatles things. He has like every record from every country. He has memorabilia and signed things and everything. And it's a collection that which I plan to go and make a video on, actually. I plan to do it this year or last year, but obviously I couldn't. Mm-hmm. And we were going to set it all up and all that sort of stuff. And because collectors love to show their collections off, you know, that's the main point of having a collection. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do that. So hopefully next year I'll go and film all this and you'll see what an incredible collection it is. Do a proper video on it, because what really annoys me is that you see these collections only when they come for sale. The local news does a piece on it or something, and they do a lighthearted little thing like, oh, oh, da, da, da. And they treat it as a thing at the end of the news, like, you know, sort of like a funny little thing. So I want to do a serious review of this collection. Mm-hmm. So that's on the cards, and hopefully that'll be able to do that next year. But that's got amazing things in it, and especially records and things which I've never seen.
Like, what would be, give us a nugget here, what would be something that we would see in that video?
You'd see every record from every country, picture sleeve, pressing. You'd see you know, Butcher covers, Indian 78s, export records, signed books, acetates. Yeah, just the list, just massive things. And that's just one collection. I'd love to do other collections like that as well. And there's a few I have planned, but obviously you can't get out of the house these days. So that's what I was originally planning to do before the pandemic struck. I went to a record fair in Utrecht, the world's biggest record fair, the last one actually before everything closed down, and did a little sort of film around there. And I thought, well, I'll visit other people's collections. And of course I couldn't, so I ended up doing things in my office here. But that would be great. I mean, to go, for example, what a wonderful thing it would be to go to Paul McCartney's house and go through his record collection. There's a picture, there's a recent picture, have you seen it, of him sitting there on his little sideboard with his record collection behind him, and you're like looking at it really close. What has he got? He's got the MFSL box there, the Beatles box there, and stuff. So that's the sort of thing I would like to do. Just look at people's collections, you know, and go through and like, do a discovery and what have they got and stuff. I've been to a few archives, but a personal collection would be really, really good. I don't really see it wouldn't be an invasion of privacy too much. They could either choose not to be in it, or they could choose to be interviewed. It doesn't really matter. And the location wouldn't be divulged. So,
oh, I think you'd be the perfect guy to do a video all about that Quarryman acetate.
Mm.
And I would imagine that he wouldn't mind talking about that. He'd want that information being shared.
Well, maybe he is. I mean, like I said, a lot of collectors love to show off their stuff. So I wouldn't think, you know, if they'd show off their stuff, even if they weren't in the video, they wouldn't mind other people looking at what they've got. You know, it's the ultimate brag, isn't it? You know, sort of you go on YouTube and you show off your stuff. So hopefully that'll sort of come to pass and things. I mean, I'm not going to run out of subjects to talk about at my desk, but I'd still like to sort of do more travelogue sort of thing as well, you know, sort of journeying to making it a whole story, you know, not just sitting in a room with somebody, but sort of going there, stories behind collections, you know, stories of how people got hold of stuff. And there's so many stories to tell, and that's really what I want to do.
Well, you're off to a really strong start.
Thanks.
Hey, back to Beatles vinyl, at least the records that most people can afford. What is, like, where would you suggest people start? Like, what is the best sounding Beatles album that's affordable?
That would be some of the German ones, actually. I've just finished a video, which will probably be out by the time people listen to this. Mm-hmm. Some of the early 70s or 70s German pressings are really good. There's a copy of Please Please Me, which was cut in 1973. A second pressing of that, which sounds incredible, much better than the British ones. And they're really pretty cheap at the moment. You know, maybe the prices will go up after the video. I don't know. But they're quite cheap. Some of the German things from the 70s are really good. And as I said, I've just done a video on it, and I haven't heard some of these before, but wow, the Magical Mystery Tour from the 1970s, the German one, is a real fantastic record. And everyone who I've sent it to who's heard it said it's the best. It's the best one ever. Some of the European pressings, I haven't done much on the American pressings. I don't have a lot of American pressings, but they tend not to sound that good from a neutral point of view. And if you grew up with them, you love the sound of those things, and that will be your version of it. But from a neutral point of view, they're not that great sounding from an audiophile point of view. And you can argue about the reverb, and you can argue about the mixes, how they add to the sound or whatever. But from the purity of the sound and what I think somebody who's never heard Beatles records before would be like some of the German ones, some of the 70s British ones, even up until sort of like the early 80s are good sounding ones, and trying to sort of show people things that are cheap and good sounding, you know. You don't have to sort of like spend a lot of money on first pressings and things. They use the same tapes, and sometimes they improve the quality later on. You know, because the limitations of the 60s technology was improved in the 70s. So, and the 70s really is like the golden age of vinyl production. So they were getting a lot of things right by that point.
Oh, one of the more expensive records of my collection is a Butcher cover, and it's also one of the worst sounding. It was really dodgy. And I assume that's because it was cobbled together from tapes of multiple generations away from the master. Yeah. But I could really hear a difference when I put it on the turntable. This is not a Beatles record I want to listen to.
Well, I think unfortunately the Americans really got the bad deal out of everything, because they got copy tapes from England, and then they were copied again, and then copied again for other parts of the country and whatever, and then they were remixed and stuff. So originally they were very badly served, you know, but not that it made a difference to the Beatles' popularity. But now when you look back on them and you say you have a fantastic Butcher cover, and it's a shame the record doesn't sound so good, but you know, you didn't buy it for the record.
That's not the selling point.
You didn't buy it for the record.
Actually, I live in Australia, and a lot of the records that we have here from the Beatles, but you know, from the 60s, were from the plates, apparently, that were spent out of the UK. So they would take the plates after they pressed 3,000 or 5,000, and then they would ship them to Australia, you know, the lesser of the Commonwealth, right? And, and so we'd still get, like, I still find Rubber Soles, the Dash Ones down here, the hot mix, the distorted mix, whatever that is. And some of the, you know, yeah, some of them are directly from those old plates.
Yeah, so the Australian ones do sound really good, actually. But the German ones didn't have the plates. They were sent the tapes and they recut them. But yeah, some of the ones sent around the world, they did send the plates to where they didn't have the facilities to sort of make their own. The loud, I know that loud cut thing is a bit annoying. A lot of people call it loud loud cut. It's just the way it was made. I have gone on record actually saying the third pressing of Rubber Soul is the best sounding mono one. The first pressing is terrible. It does sound horrible and loud cut, terrible cut. But then it was recut by EMI's top classical cutting engineer. A few months later, and there's a picture in the Beatles in Mono book where the job is designated to Harry Moss, the guy who cut the first pressing, but it's crossed out and put it's to be done by Hazel Yarwood, who was the EMI's classical cutting engineer, and she did the second -4 and -5 cuttings of Rubber Soul, and they're much less aggressive, they're much softer, and they were cut like a classical record, you know, so and they sound much better. And it's a shame she didn't cut more of the Beatles things, you know, with that approach. And some of the things that she was down for, and Harry Moss has scribbled out and put, this is mine, you know, I'm doing this one. So, you know, that was an interesting little discovery that I found about her. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Abbey Road could have sounded much different if she'd done it, you know, taking that classical approach rather than Harry Moss's sort of pop, you know, guns blazing sort of approach. But the Australian records do sound very good. And there's one very rare, great sounding Australian record, the Audio 5 version of Sgt. Pepper, which is a gem.
I held one in my hands about 4 weeks ago. It came into my friend's record shop, and yeah, I think it lasted about 8 minutes in the shop, but I didn't get a chance to hear it. I watched your video afterward. I was like, oh, just I could have hooked you up if I'd only watched that video earlier. Well, do you want me to keep an eye out for you?
Well, since the video, I've had sort of people offer me, you know, sort of files of the Audio 5 cut. So I was like, oh well, you know, it's a bit late now, but I have it now. So they sent me nice files of them. So. But it was an interesting experience to get that Nimbus cut, which was a really nice sounding record.
How does it compare to the Nimbus then? Like, where does that Australian audiophile pressing sit in the?
Well, they're pretty close. It's difficult because the files that I've got are digital and they're on a different format and it doesn't sound exactly the same as through my stereo. So the only way to do it really would be to have the two vinyl records in front of me, but they both sound fantastic. I'm not sort of saying one sounds the better, and if you had a huge, very revealing hi-fi system, you could tell. But the computer audio and my vinyl audio, I can't make a call on that, Nate. I'm sorry.
Okay, but you have the Nimbus and the UHQRs at home. Are those yours, or did you borrow them for the experiment?
No, I don't. The UHQR I had many years ago. That I sold, and the Nimbus has now gone to another home as well. So, you know, that's sort of made people happy that way. So the Nimbus is now in Japan. That's the beauty of it. I mean, it's nice. I can have these things. I can make a video about them and pass them on, you know, and I can do that again with something else and da, da, da. So I can have share it with everybody, then pass it on, and then have something else come in, share it with people, pass it on again. So that's the format I'm going to follow, you know, which enables me to sort of get interesting things, which I wouldn't really be able to afford just to keep. I can sort of have it, make a video, share it, pass it on, you know, and that's, so people watching YouTube are happy, the buyer on the other end is happy. So
Andrew, look, I could talk to you for days on this, and I think we would still not get to every topic on my list here, but I'd love to have you back on again. You know, I could talk about Beatles vinyl, and course, now you're getting into the Stones and all sorts of other collections as well. So I'd love to have you back on at some point. I'd also like to remind the audience to check out Andrew's videos, Parlagram Auctions. Do a Google search. I'll link it in this episode page. Maybe we'll even get his wish list that you can download and keep an eye out for things. But it really is such, I'm going to call it authoritative. I learned so much when I watch these videos. And I start by watching one. I'm like, oh, this is only 12 minutes. And then I find myself about 2.5 hours later, like, fuck, I had no idea about these Japanese presses.
I did one yesterday, the German one. I said, is that only 15 minutes? It takes like a week to do, and it turns out to be 15 minutes. So, you know, but people say it flies by really quickly. So I try to pack in as much as I can into a short space of time, because people, you know, the people don't have a lot of time, you know, and there's lots of other videos that need your attention too. So you've got to really jam it in.
A lot of care goes into it. I mean, I could tell a lot of production, great production values. And again, I'm glued to it. 12 minutes, just, it does fly by, and it makes me want more. Well, so
thanks. I try and put into it what I expect, what I would like to watch. You know, there's a lot of videos out there where people just sit in front of their shelf and hold stuff up. And you know, I can't do that. You know, I've got to make it a bit more visually exciting, you know, and whatever. So I put a bit more into it, you know. No, I like that side of it, you know, the creative side of it. So that's, some people are not very technical and they can't do it that way, but I try and do it to the best of my ability. And I'm glad that people appreciate it. And I thank you for having me on today. It's been really exciting. And I'd love to come back at any point in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Oh, there he is, Mr. Andrew Milton of Parlagram Auctions. Of course, you can find him at parlagramauctions.com and Google him and find his YouTube channel. It's absolutely fascinating. And don't forget, there's an extra 30 minutes of this interview up, available only to our Patreon supporters, patreon.com/vinylguide. It helps keep this show going. Join that community. You get early access to episodes, secret episodes, extended interviews, exclusive stuff up there only at patreon.com/vinylguide. And thanks in advance for your support. Alrighty, that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Please share these episodes across social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that stuff. And of course, leave us positive reviews whenever you can up at Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher, wherever. Log in there. Give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10 stars. Make us blush. Give us a great review. That is certainly appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.